Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. So do stay tuned if you've ever wondered how we get from All Saints to Halloween. How the first papal encyclical focusing on social issues stemmed from the Industrial Revolution. And finally, how the Romans envisaged the afterlife. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. Halloween has only very recently become popular here in Italy, and while it has been adopted as a fun moment, its origins may sometimes be misunderstood. According to some, it could have frightening implications. I myself heard one parish priest warn parents and children against the danger of satanic sects latching onto it. In an effort to find out more about this popular feast day which falls on the eve of All Saints, I turned to a parish priest from England. A familiar voice for regular listeners, he's Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, who beyond serving two parishes back home, is also the coordinator for Catholic contribution to Liverpool's year as a 2008 European Capital of Culture. I began by asking him to comment on the parish priest's remark I heard in church last Sunday. Here in Italy, they spoke about Halloween and warned people against the influence satanic groups might have on Halloween. Is there a connection with satanic groups, or is it just the fear of Halloween being used by satanic groups, do you think?
I think before talking about Halloween specifically, I'd just like to say I get a bit worried how easily people use the term Satanism and satanic. The French bishops published a document last year about Satanist tendencies in contemporary youth. And I read the document very carefully, and I wasn't asked to do it, but I wrote to the president of the French Bishops' Conference and said what worried me in the document, and he was very much in agreement with me. And one of the things I'd said was that the author seems to see the devil around every corner. And the cardinal said to me personally later, yes, you're absolutely right, that's his character. It's quite easy to go from talking about sects to talking about satanic sects. Satanism is specifically a vicious rejection of Christianity, or Judaism, as it happens as well, because Satanism is only born in reaction to Christianity, aggressive reaction, a fight against. But many sects just ignore the mainline religions or see themselves as an alternative way of coping with life or getting the best out of life or things like that. Magic becomes a question of dominating the powers of the universe, the forces of life. Satanism always refers itself to the devil. So to use the word satanic, I think you have to be careful. That's all I'm saying. It's easy to use it, but it's often used wrongly. Halloween makes me think of many things. Most people today think of what they can buy in their local supermarkets or shops, which are witches' hats and cloaks and all sorts of things associated with witchcraft. But I don't really know why they have gone into witchcraft, because I grew up with a very, very different experience of Halloween. Halloween was always a time to stay at home in the family where I grew up. And I've confirmed this recently with people in my new parish where I am. They had exactly the same experience. We'd stay at home and we'd practice something called duck apple. I know it has pagan links, but we weren't being pagans. We were just having fun. And the idea was partly, this is a very holy time of the year, a very spiritual time of the year. And in the oldest forms of Christianity in the British Isles, there was always a touch of the paganism that there had been beforehand. And this was supposed to be a kind of seam in the year where we were closer than ever to the spirit world. And the fact that it was All Hallows Eve, the eve of All Saints Day, meant that it wasn't just the good spirits that were about, but also bad ones. This is a very ancient fear that people had, and I think that's why we stayed in the houses. We stayed home to be safe and to be in our families, but the whole of family life has changed, and a dreadful commercial version of Halloween has come, probably from the United States, which is much more concerned with things like trick or treat. And now it's become a time when old people are afraid to stay in their homes, in my country anyway, because they're bombarded by these visits from people dressed as ghosts or ghouls, demanding money or sweets or something. And if they don't get it, they often damage the property, or they certainly frighten people. Their very appearance frightens a lot of old people. So I've asked the people in my parish, the parents, to do two things. One was to make sure they know exactly where their children are on Wednesday night this week. And the other was, maybe if they can get away with it, as I put it in the church newsletters, to say a particular prayer with the children at the evening meal. Many people don't sit down for an evening meal anymore, but it might be an excuse to do so. And just say this prayer, which I modified from the ordinary missal, from the Feast of the Purification, which talks of light and candles and the light that Christ is. One group wanted to stage a service of light on Halloween evening in the church, but they asked so late that they had no time to prepare it. So there are ways of dealing with Halloween, which I don't think we need to go to the extreme of saying it's a satanic invasion. It most certainly is not. There may be odd groups latching onto it, but Halloween itself has a very respectable Christian history. It is also to do with a Celtic tradition that I don't know how to say, Savain or Samain, I'm not sure, so sure how you say it. But it has been Christianised, and I don't think we should lose that.
There's a well-known Catholic school in England called All Hallows. It's a prep school, no? It used to be quite a common wording, All Hallows, no?
Yeah, most of the missionary priests from Ireland who were not in religious orders, the ones who were specifically ordained to work abroad, went through the seminary in Dublin called All Hallows. But people tend to forget that. I like to remind people every year that the Feast of All Saints is also called All Hallows in an older language, hence Halloween. There is an inevitable connection with the following day, which I think is a nice preparation, really.
So when you were in the seminary, were you told about All Saints as All Hallows? Or?
No, we just refer to it as All Saints. But I've always thought of it as All Hallows as well, but that's me in language. I love to know where words come from. So,
you said it was a very spiritual moment in the year. Do people in your parish relate to the Feast of All Saints?
I think it's probably a universal experience that, except where people are very theologically educated, they're much more interested in the day after, which is All Souls. So it's quite odd that the Holy Day of Obligation is All Saints, but the day when people really want to go to Mass is All Souls, because there's this enormous respect and love for our dead relatives and friends. I'm in a situation where I'm operating in two parishes at the moment, and on a weekday would normally say Mass in one of them, but I've had to put an extra Mass on for All Souls in both of them. I think I'd say it's a need, an urgent need for them to pray for their dead at that time. Theologically, All Saints would be more significant, but in fact, pastorally, we have to make space for people on All Souls too.
Why did you say theologically it would be more significant, All Saints?
Because from our baptism on, I suppose even before, if we but knew it, we're all called to become holy, and a saint means holy, or holy means saint. We forget the link, because holy has become used almost technically of particular actions that we do or particular styles of being a person. In the old days, I mean the very old days, Apostle Paul used to write to the saints, to all the saints in the various churches he'd founded or visited around Asia Minor and the Mediterranean. The Christians were called the saints. And if we're all called to holiness, we're called to an enormous, you might say, happy family of people who are at home with God. And I don't mean simply the ones in heaven. I mean also the ones who here on earth find it quite wonderful to be able to live a life close to God, which is what holiness really is. It's not being boring and sitting in church all the time and uttering pious sentences. It is being close to God, and the most useful form of being close to God is when other people recognise you as having got something from your relationship with God that they would like to have as well. Holiness ought to be catching, like the many diseases we have around the place. It would be great to have a disease, an outbreak of holiness, an epidemic, and I think that's what All Saints is about.
Our thanks there go to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood, who, beyond serving two parishes in England, is also coordinator for Catholic contribution to Liverpool's year as the 2008 European Capital of Culture. Meanwhile, as announced a few moments ago, it's time to begin a series of broadcasts focusing on social encyclicals. We do this with a professor of Catholic social teaching at the Pontifical University of St. Thomas here in Rome, more popularly referred to as the Angelicum. He's Dominican Father Alejandro Crosswaite. Popes only started writing about social issues at the end of the 19th century, no?
Yes.
Before that, what happened? I mean, didn't the popes take any interest in social issues, or were there other channels?
Okay. I think the common perception is that the encyclicals or social issues were not dealt by the Church until Leo XIII. But actually, from the very beginning of the history of the Church, we have the Church being concerned about social causes and social issues. So if we actually look at the fathers of the Church, for example, John Chrysostom speaks about the role of charity and the need for especially the upper classes to be concerned about the peasants and to be concerned about the working classes. And that goes through the entire history of the Church. And of course, we have St. Thomas Aquinas, who begins to systematize a little bit more of what it means, the whole role of justice and the virtue of justice and the relationship of the Christian with regards to the virtue of justice. So little by little, the Church begins to systematize its teaching on social justice, as well as the Holy Fathers begin to write several letters throughout the history, especially in the 18th and 17th century, dealing with particular issues in particular regions of the world. But what changes is that after the Industrial Revolution, society itself changes so radically. Problems of the workers is increased, especially with the migration from the fields and so on into the cities, into the factories, and basically causing new problems.
So it was this realization that the Church needed to address the problem of social issues in a new way that inspired Pope Leo XIII to express his concern regarding the working class with the encyclical Rerum Novarum, right?
The Church begins to see that it needs to address this problem in a new way. And so we have especially Leo XIII concerned about the situation of the workers, who also at that time begin to turn more to the communist groups, who at that time seems to be the ones that really are trying to reach out to the working class. And the Church is seen as distant and not really involved in the life of the workers and more with the industrialists and so on. Leo immediately perceives this. And so he begins to think about a social encyclical that somehow will deal with the working problem and somehow also bring the worker classes, and especially the unions and so on, into the Church.
So what does he do? He surrounds himself with members of the hierarchy, like cardinals, who were knowledgeable in matters regarding social justice. For example, Cardinal Manning from England, who was instrumental in settling the London dock strike in 1889.
Yes.
And I think there was a German cardinal involved
Kettler,
as well.
Yes.
Kettler, because they were already knowledgeable. Tapping into their knowledge on social justice.
Yes.
Is that right?
Correct. In the 19th century, there's several movements within the hierarchy, especially in Germany and in France and the United States, as well as especially in England, that are already creating study groups or are creating small communities of workers where they gather together, usually with priests and so on, to deal with what the scriptures have to say to the social problems. And so that's how some of the bishops also become more conscious of the problems out there. So they begin to organize also movements within their own diocese. The most famous one, of course, is in the Diocese of Mainz in Germany, Kettler, who really organizes study groups precisely to start looking at what does the Church have to say to the social issues and what can the Church offer that. And in one sense, they're very practical groups because it's not just theoretical, but it's, okay, how can we transform the working world, basically. And that's where you start seeing letters, for example, from Kettler addressing the workers in his own diocese, giving them principles and so on.
So if I understand correctly, it all took place from the outside in. That's to say, when the Holy See got to know about what was happening in the local churches, the dialogue began.
And it's actually the bishops that begin to write to the Vatican asking them, we need to address this issue, which is now quite a serious issue, and we're losing the workers. And this is the call precisely that Leo XIII hears, as well as the theologians here in Rome.
Was his encyclical unpopular at the time? It must have been a bit of a bombshell, no, within society.
It's a new encyclical. It's something that had not been seen in a systematic way that only addresses the issues of industrialization, the relationship between labor and capital, and so on. So it was something completely new. And actually, it was very well received, especially in secular circles. So workers' circles really felt that the church was reaching out to them, that they were finally being listened to. More conservative groups within the church had a little bit more difficulty because there were several movements to kind of go back to the old order. But in general, the encyclical received great reviews in secular newspapers, especially in the United States and in France. So in general, I think it was a good reception of the encyclical.
We're talking 1891 when this encyclical Rerum Novarum, literally of new things, was released. You mentioned communism. At the time, communism wasn't as we know it today. It was something in the making, wasn't it?
Yes.
There were ideas being bandied about, that sort
correct.
Of thing. Is that correct?
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, there were several socialist movements. By this time, of course, we don't even have the Russian Revolution and so on, but the ideas are already out there. And so especially within the workers, there are several movements that also were like anarchist movements here in Italy, as well as other parts of Europe, that were trying to give an answer to the social questions of justice and so on, and basing themselves on the writings of Marx and Engels and so on, trying to address this. And they were winning a lot of people, especially through the unions and different workers' organizations.
This was something that was happening across most of Europe, no? So how did this affect the church at a parish level?
Parish priests are aware of this, and so you still see a lot of concern, especially a lot of writings during this time, being concerned about this. And of course, the main concern is the atheism that is there and that is kind of being basically taught within these groups. That was the biggest concern, and somehow that they're losing these workers instead of joining the different organizations that the church had at that time, which would be a little bit the beginnings of Catholic Action and so on.
So it did have a political impact.
It did have a definitely political impact,
and,
yes.
And it's generally accepted to be the founding document of Christian democracy, no?
Correct, yes.
Is that correct?
Yes. Well, I mean, Rerum Novarum is still very beginning encyclical. And you still see a lot of reflection of the vision of society of the ancient church. So it does tend to be a little paternalistic. And by that sense, I mean, it tends to call upon the state and it tends to call upon industrialists to take care of the poor, to take care of the workers, as opposed to asking the workers or seeing the workers, as John Paul II will say in Laborum Exertium, as subjects. People that can actually transform their own workplace and they are active participants in the transformation of society. We don't see that in Rerum Novarum. It's still more of a patronistic way in the sense is the upper classes taking care of the multitudes. And this is a big issue that will be dealt throughout those early encyclicals. What is our vision or the church's vision or the hierarchy's vision of the people? And it's at this early stage, and I would say before Vatican II, it is a vision of the multitude. And the multitude is being influenced, I would say, by different currents that somehow are taking them away from the church. And so there's this concern, a paternalistic concern on the part of the hierarchy, as well as high people in society. So the first encyclicals and the first movements, especially in Germany, like Kettler and so on, are trying to say we most composed of royalty, that's our responsibility, our social responsibility to take care of the workers. So the encyclical reflects that. So the main task is given to the state, who is to basically take care of the workers. And the church's mission is to teach the values, keep reminding the state to take care of the workers. It's not until much, much later, and you could say until Vatican II, basically, although we already start seeing that in Pius XII in his Christmas radio messages, and we begin to see that in John the 23rd's writings, that the worker himself or herself is a subject. somebody who actually has something to say and is called to be an active member. And that will not be explicit until John Paul II in Laborum Exercitium, where he says workers are subjects, people that can transform their society.
So one can say that it broke down barriers between the church and workers, this encyclical in a sense, which I think is symbolized in the tomb of Leo XIII in St. John Lateran, which has lots of different elements. And one of the elements is this worker, which is unusual, no?
Yes, quite. But again, I mean, I think it was important for Leo to show the solidarity that the church had with the working world and the issues that the workers were going through.
You've been listening to the first in a series of programs focusing on the papal encyclicals on social issues. That's with Dominican Father Alejandro Crosthwaite, who's just been speaking to us of Leo XIII's encyclical Rerum Novarum, and who in the next installment will be moving ahead 40 years, that's with Pope Pius XI. Meanwhile, on a totally different note, time to join our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, for our weekly rendezvous. Today he speaks to us of the afterlife at the time of the Romans. Father, I'd like to begin by asking you a question. Who was the mythical ferryman the Romans believed took them across the river Styx to the underworld?
Yeah, Charon. Charon. He's on the back wall of the Sistine Chapel. You ever seen that? And he has his bolter and he has a big stick that he's using to propel his boat. Charon, C-H-A-R-O-N.
So the river Styx was a mythical river?
Yeah, the underworld, Styx.
Mm. How do you say underworld in Latin?
Is an inferorum, inferorum. Inferorum of hell or the underworld?
Inferi in Italian means...
Yes, really hell or the lower parts.
I believe that one of the things the Romans did, because they used to put a coin in dying people's mouths to pay the fee for Charon. Is it just a story?
Yeah, sounds like a story. The Romans were not disturbed by this whole thing of death as we are today.
But they had burials, though.
Ceremonies. Even Cicero talks about his father dying. He says, Pater decessit. Daddy died last week, and he goes on to something else. I mean, they didn't have this obsession with death as we do. It was just part of things, boo.
But they have left us elaborate tombs, though.
Oh, yeah, that's all right.
Which is indicative that they did somehow...
They respected the person, and... I don't know about the future or not, that's another story. But
at any rate, they had these funerals with processions. You know what I discovered is that cypress trees that you see in cemeteries, they were indicative in Roman times of
immortality.
Of immortality, like. And they used to have them at funerals.
Mm-hmm.
How do you say cypress tree?
And cypressus. Cypressus. Cypressus is Greek, really.
It was part of the Greek heritage.
Really, the idea was...
Prosaically. How do you say undertaker in... did they exist?
Vespilio.
They did exist, undertakers.
Vespilio, certainly they had.
Another thing I read was that during the funeral procession, the dead person was placed in a sort of lifelike position in a litter. Well, obviously, when it was a rich, wealthy person, though. Is that correct?
Yeah, like on a stretcher or a thing there. Mm. Like sitting up.
You mentioned Cicero as saying, well, Daddy died, right? But they did have this procession. They did eat, and they have banquets before and after.
Some, not all. I mean, some people just kind of disappeared. This didn't happen every single day or with every single family. Mm. Heaven's sakes, no.
It's just
not right.
But there was a speech, and then afterwards they were cremated.
Is that right?
Well, that's based like on the whole thing with Julius Caesar.
That is to say?
Yeah, I mean, Mark Antony's speech and the cremation of Caesar and all that. But I mean, for normal people, that wasn't the case.
And the speech was in the Roman Forum, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that where they went?
The procession was going through the Forum.
Why through the Forum?
Well, it's just like a public parade, which was really illegal. They weren't supposed to do it. But they wanted to show off Caesar. They had him like in a stretcher, like in a litter. And they wanted to show him off. His followers did. And so they marched him through the Forum. And then someone grabbed a firebrand and threw it into this thing, and they started a fire, and that's how he was cremated in the Forum, which, again, was against the law.
Why was it against the law?
Well, you couldn't bury or cremate in the city.
Outside the city walls, it had to happen.
Yes, for fire or health reasons.
Well, hygiene, obviously, because Rome was very crowded in those days,
wasn't it? Yeah, that's how you get the catacombs outside the walls.
The catacombs, well, the Christians were buried in the catacombs, so
no? Well, Romans too. I mean, all kinds of Romans out there too.
Christians.
I mean, all of the whole Via Appia, for 10, 15 miles, were all tombs with these cypress trees around them. Mm-hmm. But that's all outside the city.
We see them in depictions by Piranesi, in etchings, no?
Oh, yeah. You can go out there even today and see them.
I read somewhere that some of the better-off people were placed to rest in niches in these urns, in sort of dovecotes. What were they called?
Columbarium.
What's the reason for them to be called columbaria? Because they looked like...
Well, yeah, exactly. Looked like a whole colony of doves. Each one would have its own little place there.
That was all underground?
The ones we have are underground. Yes, because like on the Via Appia.
But they used to be also above ground then.
Mm-hmm.
So it was only Styx that went to the underworld, the actual bodies. The river Styx.
I like it, Styx.
You like it?
I like the whole, yeah, Stygium.
The concept.
Ad Stygium. Send this man to Stygium. Send him to the Styx River. I sent him to hell, got the idea.
But the poor didn't have the privilege of having a proper burial. They were just shoveled under, no? How would you say shoveled under the Esquiline Hill?
De Fodiebantur.
This whole concept of outside the walls was a big thing in Roman times, wasn't it?
What do you mean outside the walls?
Outside the city walls.
Well, that was the law from way, way back, from 500 BC. Well, 350 BC, you couldn't bury or cremate within the walls. So the first emperor was really a Trajan, which is 110, 117 after Christ, which means the rule applied with no exceptions for almost 500 years.
A huge thank you there to our popular Latin lover. He's Carmelite father, Reginald Foster, and he's currently working in the Vatican as the Pope's own Latinist. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbury. Be sure to check out our website. The address is www.vaticanradio.org.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.